It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's St. Patrick's Day, and Americans are celebrating Irish culture and heritage. But it wasn't always celebrated. Our guest historian shares the troubled road faced by Irish immigrants.
First, Crimeans voted yesterday to secede from Ukraine and join Russia. The referendum, which took place with thousands of armed Russian troops occupying Crimea, was strongly opposed by Western leaders.
Now that the votes have been cast, the request remains, what does the United States do next? President Obama gave at least a partial answer to that question today, announcing sanctions targeted against some Russian leaders.
Political observer Jeremy Suri joins us now to explore U.S. options, and he is the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs, History, and Public Policy at the University of Texas, Austin. His latest book is Liberty's Surest Guardian. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
So we've got some news in. According to the New York Times, Vladimir Putin signed a decree late Monday night formally recognizing Ukraine's Crimea region as a sovereign and independent state, and this seeming to lay the groundwork for possible annexation seems to be his response to the sanctions that President Obama announced earlier in the day. What does this mean? What's the significance of this sovereign and independent state decree?
Well, I think President Putin is definitely moving toward either making Crimea part of Russia or making it a vassal state for Russia, and he's moving as fast as he can to make this an accomplishment on the ground before anyone can do anything about it.
Well, Vladimir Putin said the vote that we just talked about was consistent with the right of self-determination. President Obama and other Western leaders saying that it took place under military duress and it won't be recognized. It's illegal. So where does that put things in the balance of power between Russia and some of the Western nations we're talking about?
Well, Putin's effort is to try to give legitimacy to what was not a fair vote. You don't have a fair vote when people with guns are standing by the voting booth, and you never have a fair vote when you get a 96% result. The population of Crimea is about 60% Russian. There's no way that 96% of the population would have in any fair vote voted for this. There was clearly intimidation and voter fraud going on. Putin is trying to make this look legitimate, and it is our job, as it would be if this were a stolen election anywhere else, to be truth tellers and make it clear this was a stolen election and it's not legitimate what he did.
It's an interesting thing reading the New York Times even today talking about the vote. There's lots of Russians who are profiled as celebrating, you know, hoisting pro-Russian banners, celebrating in the streets. And the voices that you're talking about saying this is rigged are not coming out of Crimea. What do we need to do to get that story then?
Well, the voices are not coming out of Crimea, Veronica, because there are guys with guns standing there stopping them from voicing themselves and also controlling reporters in the area. So, you know, it's the same reason they're not voices coming out of North Korea right now. But all of that said, what we need to do, I think, is not pretend that we can solve this problem. But we need to make it clear that this kind of stolen election is not something that we are going to accept as a legitimate form of behavior, because it could happen elsewhere if that's the case. There are Russians, ethnic Russians, throughout other countries and other parts of Ukraine, and we cannot have elections or kangaroo courts going on everywhere to break off pieces of Poland and the Baltic states and eastern Ukraine and make them part of Russia tomorrow. So I think it is important that we give voice to what are legitimate concerns about the way this vote occurred.
And that's what President Obama is saying, that this is not legal. It will not be recognized. So he's got sanctions in his hip pocket that he's wanting to use this morning, including freezing visas and financial assets. How effective is that strategy going to be?
Well, I think in the long run, sanctions can be very effective. What we've learned about sanctions is they don't work in the short term. They don't create immediate changes of behavior. If anything, they mobilize people to resist. But over the long term, for a society like Russia that is dependent upon two things, the export of energy products and the ability of wealthy people to travel around the world and buy things up and feel that they are strong because they're able to do that, and if the United States and the European Union are able to restrict the ability of Russia to trade, sell, and buy overseas, that will have an effect. It will hurt the Russian economy, and it will be a cost that Putin will have to deal with in the long term. But it's not going to force him out of Crimea tomorrow.
So what does it mean? You mentioned the vassal state possibility. What would that look like?
So a vassal state would be something similar to what the Soviet Union had in parts of Eastern Europe and what the Russian Empire and other empires had in prior centuries, which is where a strong state pretty much dictates the behavior of a neighboring state, but does this in ways that are sometimes indirect and don't involve directly ruling or occupying that state, but largely determine the outcome of decisions that are made in that state. Some could argue that the United States sometimes does this with states in the Caribbean.
So would that be a better case scenario than full-on annexation and reincorporation of Crimea, or is it just both lose-lose, either of those options?
Yeah, both are bad, particularly if you are one of the non-Russians in Crimea, particularly if you're a Tatar. Let's remember that the Tatar population was forcibly removed by Stalin. They only recently returned in the last 20 to 30 years. And this is not a good thing for them. This is not a good thing for Ukrainians in the area. I don't know if one is better than the other. Both are not good outcomes if you care about democracy and you care about the rule of law.
Well, let's talk about that aspect for a moment. There are ethnic Russians in Crimea, as you said, 60%, but there are also Crimean Tatars, as you were saying, other ethnicities, and young people who don't remember a time when Crimea was part of the USSR. They identify as Ukrainians. What would a break from Ukraine mean for a group with that much plurality?
Well, I think it's going to mean a lot of bad things. First of all, it's going to mean that they're going to face intensive pressure to do things that would favor Russia, not favor Ukraine, or favor activities that would be closer to the European Union. It's going to mean, I think, very directly that some of them are going to lose their property. I think there's going to be violence toward those who are seen as traitors internally. The next argument you will see soon will be an argument that the Ukrainians and Tatars who are in Crimea are traitors, that they are not loyal, and that something must be done about them. As it is, ethnic minorities within Russia face terrible prejudices right now. So this is not good at all for these non-Russian peoples living in Crimea. Let's remember, Russia is a virtually dictatorial state now. There's very little room left for opposition. There's very little free media. We should expect all those things to go away in Crimea, too.
Now, one tangle here that I wonder if it will have any bearing is that if Russia moves to annex Crimea, it might have a logistical nightmare on its hands figuring out things like infrastructure and utilities. Crimea is an isolated peninsula. Would that be any kind of deterrent?
Well, so here's the problem, that it actually creates an incentive for Putin, even if he doesn't want to wage a wider war, it creates an incentive for him to take other pieces of Ukraine where there are infrastructural elements like power stations and electrical parts of the electrical grid. That would be necessary or virtually necessary to manage things in Crimea. So this creates an incentive for more expansion. That's, of course, what the Ukrainians are worried about, and there have been allegations already that Russian soldiers have moved into some isolated areas in Ukraine that control power stations for Crimea. Those have not been confirmed as far as I know, but there is already rumor of this.
Now, President Putin has appeared confident throughout all this. He attended the end of the Paralympic Games. He's kind of thumbed his nose at the G7, and there's talk of troops moving around, as you just said. He doesn't seem to be backing down. So what do we expect to happen at this point with a figure like Putin, who is so confident at this point and seems like limited options outside of sanctions at this point from, for instance, President Obama?
Well, it's a good question, Veronica, but I think that the premise is not entirely right. I don't think Putin is confident. I think this is an act of insecurity. This is an act of someone who's not confident. If he were confident in Russia's strength and its magnetism for people around it, he wouldn't need to do this. He would assume that Ukraine and Crimea would naturally look toward Russia because Russia would be the natural economic power and cultural home they would want to look toward. He clearly doesn't believe this, and I think this was not the best chosen option on his list of options either. He's doing this out of weakness, and he's doing this, I think, because he believes his power is diminishing. If you look at the demographics of Russia, and if you look at the way world energy markets are working, Russia's main source of people and money is declining. So I think he's doing this out of weakness, but I think he is confident that the United States will not respond in this case in a way that would have military or direct economic harm immediately to him. We need to show, though, that there will be penalties to be paid and certainly deter him from doing this anywhere else, which I don't think is beyond the realm of possibility.
Some of the reporting I've seen has suggested that the situation we're in right now and the back and forth between President Obama and Vladimir Putin is reminiscent of the Cold War. Do you see it that way? Are we sort of re-entering that era again?
No, I don't think it's a Cold War. I don't think that's a good analogy because we don't have an ideological conflict between capitalism and communism, and Russia is not offering a different economic system. It's a full actor in the capitalist world system. It's a very corrupt actor, but it's an actor in the capitalist world system in the way China is too. So this is not a Cold War. This is great power politics, but it is great power politics where one actor, Vladimir Putin, is a fascist, and we should recognize him for what he is. That does not mean he's Adolf Hitler. He's not. He doesn't have a plan to take over the world. He's not trying to kill 6 or 7 million Jews. But he is a fascist. He rules as a dictator. He believes that Russian national power is the most important thing and that it should be asserted wherever possible. And he believes that the world is out to get him, particularly the United States, that we are unfair to Russia. And he is operating as an aggressive fascist state. And what we have learned historically is that fascist states are not necessarily going to take over the world, but they need to be contained. And I think that's what we need to be prepared to do, to contain him through economic and, if necessary, military means.
Jeremy, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for coming on and talking again.
Thank you for having me on.
We've been talking to Jeremy Suri, professor of public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. His latest book is Liberty's Surest Guardian.